Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Hello, I'm Tom Gilson. Over the past several weeks here at ID the Future, we've presented five talks given at a symposium in honor of the late Philip E. Johnson. Johnson was affectionately and accurately known as the godfather of the intelligent design movement, and today we offer two final and very moving talks in that series, coming from his actual memorial service last November. The first speaker you'll hear is Emily Johnson, who's a professor of Russian at the University of Oklahoma, but on that day what mattered most was that she was Philip Johnson's daughter. The second speaker you'll hear is Stephen C. Meyer, director of the Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture.
In 1998, when I was on a one-year visiting appointment at Williams College, my dad took advantage of a long-standing invitation from a campus Christian group and came out for a week to give lectures and meet with students on campus, mostly, I think, because it gave him a chance to visit with me. I will never forget this long, leisurely visit, which was both wonderful and a little surreal. I took my father to eat at the Williams Faculty Club, just like he had taken me to the faculty club at UC Berkeley when I was little. Giant posters of my father decorated half of campus. And groups of enthusiasts, and this is really funny because we look a lot alike, so showing up at 8 a.m. for my Russian class was a little bit of a shock that morning. Groups of enthusiastic students followed us from place to place. What's it like to have a father who's a prophet? One of my dad's most fervent admirers asked, as I recall, as we were passing through Williams' manicured grounds on the way to one of his events. I was so startled that I choked on my coffee, and it took me a moment to formulate a reply. I said that for me, he was really just dad, and it was hard to think of him in any other way. And that's still true. I am proud of everything that my dad achieved, both in his legal career and later in life as a public intellectual and a religious thinker. But I remember him and will miss him as a father. He is the man who, when I couldn't sleep at night when I was little, would play gin rummy with me for hours, or would walk me down to a smoke-filled working-class bowling alley in Oakland to shoot a few games. On the way home, as I recall, and you should imagine this as midnight and me at age 7, we always stopped at the liquor store for chocolate chewing gum and cigars. Dad read me Oz books beginning when I was 3 years old, and for years added to my collection at Christmas time, hunting down rare, long out-of-print titles in local antique stores. When I was in fourth and fifth grade, he walked me to school every day, recounting the history of World War I and World War II on the way, something I just loved. He took me and my brother Tom into San Francisco for dim sum and matinees of Broadway musicals, almost always stopping at the St. Francis Hotel so that we could ride up and down the elevator at least a half a dozen times. He took us to Pajaro Dunes on vacation and rented a three-seated bike so that we could ride about as a family. He drove me to swim meets. We ate pie together at the Madonna Inn and toured the Hearst Castle as my dad recited Dorothy Parker verses from memory and regaled me with the escapades and foibles of old-time Hollywood stars. He taught me how to drive in three doubtless trying days, his foot braced on an imaginary chicken brake the entire time. When I got a tenure-track job at the University of Oklahoma, he accompanied me in my Honda Civic on my cross-country move from New York with my scraggly dog in the back seat. We ate red vines and beef jerky and listened to Trollope on tape, which my dog, for some reason, just loved. The dog started to cry whenever the tape shut off, which entertained my dad to no end. In recent years, Dad and I visited by phone, and when my daughter Soraya and I could come to Berkeley, we talked about the books we were reading, on the contents of the latest issues of the New Yorker and City Magazine, and about the world of higher education. And we also talked about sports. When I was in Berkeley with my dad, we enjoyed watching golf together, mostly because it provided a great background for a light conversation. As Dad used to say, the great thing about watching golf is that it isn't so interesting that you actually have to focus on it. If you nod off or start talking and miss a few shots, you can still follow what is going on. And so we sat and talked and watched as Rory McIlroy, Dad's favorite player, and Brooks Koepka passed through beautiful expanses of green. I'm really glad to be here with you at this memorial service and to remember my wonderful dad. Excuse me. A man with a warm heart and an encyclopedic memory for both historic facts and ribald verse and a great love of fun. I am sad that I will not get to watch golf with my dad again or call him on to chat on the phone, but I'm glad that he is at peace. And it is a joy to celebrate his memory.
Thank you, Emily. I thought I learned a long time ago not to follow a Johnson in speaking, but here I am again. It's been said that courage is in shorter supply than brilliance. Our dear friend Phil had an ample measure of both and something else. He had a great mind, he had a courageous heart, he had a tremendous gift for friendship. And I'd like to reflect on each of those. I first met Phil in 1987. I was a grad student in Cambridge, and I got a call from a friend, Mark Laberton, a great friend, and he said, there's this quirky but brilliant law professor from back home in Berkeley, and he's over here on sabbatical. He's supposed to be studying torts, and he's gotten obsessed with evolution. Would you talk to him, he said. Now, the manner of Mark's request made me think that he was hoping maybe I'd talk Phil out of whatever this obsession was. So he set up a little luncheon at a place called the Arena Tavern, which was on a charming medieval street in Cambridge called the Free School Lane. Happened to be right next door to the Cavendish Laboratory, where Watson and Crick had elucidated the structure of DNA. We made small talk for almost no time at all, and then dove right into the subject. And if some of you will know Mark from his tenure as the senior pastor here, and may know that he had this wonderful expressive eyebrow that he could cock when things were just a little bit off. And I think he had hoped maybe I would talk Phil out of this, and within 5 minutes it was clear we were on the same wavelength. And I looked across the table and there was the eyebrow rising. Anyway, there's a passage in the New Testament that says, St. Paul says, therefore we come against every argument and pretension that sets itself up against the knowledge of God and take captive every thought and making it subject to Christ. And I think this is what animated Phil. And he had gotten seized with this whole issue of Darwinian evolution because he saw in it a pretension that was displacing the knowledge of God. And his great insight that caused many people to sort of gather around him was that the argument for Darwinian evolution wasn't displacing God, it was presupposing that God hadn't had anything to do with the creation of life in the first place. And instead there was an assumption that natural processes had done it all by themselves. And that assumption, he thought, was fascinating and needed scrutiny. And many, many other scholars and scientists were attracted to this insight. Now, I continued on in grad school and finished in the fall of 1990. Phil went back, and by the time I got home, he was already making waves and was, I would say, quite famous. His new book, Darwin on Trial, had been reviewed in Science and Nature and Scientific American, and I think it was reviewed in Scientific American by no less a distinguished evolutionary biologist than Stephen Jay Gould. Now, I also mentioned that Phil was a very courageous person. Soon after the review was published in 1991, some very distinguished American intellectuals set up a debate for Professor Philip Johnson and Professor Stephen Jay Gould in closed session at the Campion Center at Harvard. Now, I was too young an academic to have been invited to such a thing at the time, but some very distinguished people reported afterwards that it was a draw. And this was quite an extraordinary story, because Phil reflected on it later to some of us, and he said, well, imagine that you had taken up golf a year ago and gotten a match with Jack Nicklaus and then played him to overtime. And he said he realized at that point, having had this encounter with Gould, that there was some upside in this. And one thing he reported as well is that was kind of encouraging to him was that most of the academics and scientists who were there thought it was a draw. But afterwards, Phil went up full of his energy and goodwill and gave Steve Gould this big hug. And he said the thing that struck him was that Gould was still shaking somewhat nervously and was quite sweaty. And Phil thought, maybe there is some upside in this. So, but as I mentioned, in addition to his courage, and that was a very courageous thing to do, to take on such a prominent person within a year of taking up this subject, he also had a gift for friendship. Another debate that he had illustrated this beautifully. Some of you may have even attended. It was at Stanford in 1994. He had a debate with the Cornell evolutionary biology professor, Will Provine. And it was a fascinating and spirited debate, and Phil came with no PowerPoint, no notes, as usual, using his voice and his mind to make his case. Will Provine was using PowerPoint and had a terrific presentation with all bullet points. But when they got to the rebuttal period, Provine started by complimenting Phil, saying that he had a razor-sharp intellect. In fact, there was no doubt he was probably smarter than Charles Darwin, but the problem was he just didn't know anything. And so he then had a series of rebuttal points, and every time he would quote something that Phil had said, he would bring up this bull and then put a kind of Ghostbuster sign through it. And so he brought out the bull to refute Phil's, you know, fallacious statement. And so Phil got up for his rebuttal to the rebuttal, and without missing a beat, he said, well, my dear friend Will has paid me a wonderful compliment, so I will repay him in kind. Will Provine, he said, has one of the great minds of the 19th century. And it absolutely brought the house down. You'd think after an exchange like this that these two guys would all walk off the stage, you know, in pique with each other. But in fact, they went out and talked long into the night. And this was the start of a 21-year friendship, Will Provine having died in 1995. We have on our website at Discovery Institute a beautiful tribute that Phil wrote to Professor Provine, who many times invited Phil to come and speak to his classes in Cornell, though they were on the opposite side of the issue. Now, these virtues that I admired in Phil, his great mind, his courage, his friendship, continued even after the two strokes, and they were often in evidence in some ways that, if anything, I admired more than all the wonderful things I saw in his prime. And in particular, his courage. He embraced this new role that he had after the stroke with some tenacity. He felt he continued to write, he continued to read, and sometimes speak, although because he would lose track of time, I remember in one particular speaking engagement, he had me interview him so I could tell him when it was time to stop. The stroke affected his sense of time. But he also was really dedicated to being a good companion to Kathy, and he talked to me about that a lot, and that he felt it was important that he was cheerful. And so there's a verse in the New Testament that always makes me think of him. It's the one in Philippians where it says, whatever is true and whatever is noble and whatever is right and whatever is pure and whatever is lovely and admirable, if anything is excellent or worthy of praise, think on such things. And Phil used his considerable mind to stay focused on those things, those pure and admirable and true things, to keep his spirits up. And he did that, I think, as an act of love for those who were caring for him. And as to the friendship, we received a most memorable tribute to Phil just a few days ago from another debate adversary, or friend, Michael Ruse. They were born the same year, 3 days apart. They felt a special kinship. They were on completely the opposite sides of the intelligent design debate. But this is what Professor Ruse said in his short tribute that we posted on our website last week. He said, though we were very much on different sides of the ID debate, nevertheless, I think I can truly say that our intellectual and faith differences made no difference as to our personal respect and, dare I say, affection. Jesus taught in the New Testament that we're to love our enemies. Phil Johnson did this so well that even his enemies loved him back.
That was Emily Johnson and Stephen C. Meyer speaking at the memorial service held for Philip E. Johnson last November. For more talks in this series honoring Philip Johnson, go to ideathefuture.com and search for his name there. For ID of the Future, I'm Tom Gilson. Thank you for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID of the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org and ideathefuture.com.